Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. She might not be as well known as Motown greats like Stevie Wonder, Smokey Robinson, and Diana Ross, but without the trailblazing career of Mary Wells, those artists might not be the household names they are today. Wells was a Detroit teenager, a firebrand who rose from the poverty of her youth to help bring international acclaim and the sales that came with it to Berry Gordy's latest foray into the music business, Motown Records. But Wells wasn't discovered from obscurity as much as she cornered Gordy in a club to sing him an original song. Before long, Wells was Motown's first female solo artist, and by 1964, she rose to the top of the charts with My Guy. Stick together, I'm telling you from the start, I can't be torn apart. Soon she was touring with the Beatles and singing duets with Marvin Gaye. But the same artist who helped bridge the gap between black and white pop music would spurn Motown at age 21. To her dying day at just 49, through lawsuits and decades of acrimony, Wells felt she'd been lied to and abused by Motown, even as she continued to sing her hits to appreciative crowds on the road. Peter Benjaminson, who's written extensively on Motown, is the author of the new book Mary Wells, The Tumultuous Life of Motown's First Superstar, which is published by Chicago Review Press. And he joins us now. Peter Benjaminson, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So did you feel that Mary Wells' story has not been told adequately? I mean, is she not as well known as she should be?
Definitely not. If Mary hadn't shown up to be Motown's first big solo female superstar, the company might have faltered and died. And that, I think, would have left America without the real addition of Motown to America's musical history, which is that it records black music and sells it to both black and white people. I mean, that's the basis of all American popular music. And Mary was certainly influential in causing that to happen.
So what made her stand out then in that era of pop culture?
She was a high school student when she joined Motown, which shows how young the people were there. She did not have any extensive musical training. Some of the Supremes did, and some of the other groups that worked for Motown and became big stars. She basically was self-taught and had a natural talent, and for lack of a better word, forced herself on Motown by showing up, as you indicated, when Gordy was running a couple of acts at a nightclub. She insisted that he listen to a song that she had written herself and was going to sing herself right there, which she basically insisted on singing it. He listened to it. He heard her natural talent and her talent as a songwriter, and he called her down to the studio the next day, signed a contract, and had her record her first song. The first song was a hit, and that's what distinguished her at Motown. She went on from there to have numerous other hits, ending at Motown with her mega hit, My Guy.
Why didn't she continue as a songwriter? I mean, on Motown, it seemed like there was a clear separation between the performers and the songwriting duos and sometimes trios that would pen the hits.
That's a good question. And the reason is basically because of its Detroit location and Gordy's ability to absorb the better ideas from his surroundings. I mean, he worked as an assembly line worker for a couple of years at Ford Motor Company's Lincoln Mercury division, and he absorbed the positive aspects of the automobile industry, which was an assembly line operation with gleaming products and parts that could be used in various different models, and the moving of those parts basically from one assembly line to another. So that's what he did at Motown. It was basically like a three-year or four-year operation. The first gear was a revolving group of songwriters. The second gear was a revolving group of vocalists. The third was a revolving group of producers, that is, producers of songs. And they keep revolving, clicking at each stop on the gear until they got a hit out of one combination of producer, songwriter, and vocalist. And that made the company very efficient and gave Mary a chance to get in there as a vocalist. But to answer your actual question, she was a better singer than a songwriter. She had a great voice and a great ability to modulate the voice and to get different emotions out in her voice. So while she was an adequate songwriter, Motown had much better songwriters in their stable. So in the end, they had Smokey Robinson match with Mary Wells as songwriter and singer, and the combination worked very well.
Reading your book, it seemed like sort of a paradox for Mary Wells, because from not writing her own hits, she was left short on the royalties end and ended up in court with Motown for a long time, hashing out, you know, the percentages. But because she sang these great songs, she ended up with chart-topping hits. They didn't have to be hers for the notoriety to come about. So it's kind of hard to imagine where she would have been without, you know, a song like My Guy.
Yes, that's true. But what you're hitting on is, I think, a basic unfairness in the American record industry. If a songwriter records a song that he or she does not write, and it's played on the radio, you know, a million times, which is certainly less than My Guy has been played on the radio since the 60s, he or she, the singer, gets no royalties. Only the songwriter or the producer, or both, gets the royalties. It's an amazing gap in American law, which is not a gap in Europe. In Europe, if you sing a song, whether you write and or produce it or not, every time it's played on the radio, you get a few cents, and that few cents mounts up quickly when you have hits that are then played over 40 years.
So then how did the break with Motown come about?
Well, she was encouraged by her ex-husband, Herman Griffith.
And we should say one of many husbands.
Yes, that's right. She had three husbands. Two she married, and the third she had a common law relationship with. Yes, but Herman's particular sin was that he kept telling her that she was a big star, or that is a bigger star than she was at Motown, and that she could make hundreds of thousands of dollars more than she was making if she went out on her own. Now, he undoubtedly saw himself as the manager of an independent popular star, able to pocket whatever the manager's percentage would be, which in those days could have been up to 50% or so of her earnings. Now, if she had been able to be as successful outside of Motown as she was inside of Motown, that would have made sense. And, you know, the reason she listened to him at all, she wasn't a stupid woman, she was smart. The reason she listened to him is because she knew that she was being underpaid compared to the other vocalists who had hits on the chart at the same time she did, but who did not work for Motown. Various people like Jackie Wilson were earning something like $250,000 a year in total royalties, while she was getting only around $70,000 a year. Now, $70,000 a year isn't too bad right now. A lot of people would take that gladly, and it was tremendous in the 60s, but still, she was comparing herself, as I think is legitimate, to the other stars who were making more than three times as much as she was making, and she wanted some of that money. She grew up in a poor family. Just comfort wasn't enough for her. She really wanted enough money to be totally secure for the rest of her life. Unfortunately, that was a mistake, because although she had hits at various companies after she left Motown, they were never enough to bring her back up to the level that she had earned at Motown, and she became queen of the oldies, which kept her working, but not at a very great wage rate.
And sadly, you chronicle the way when she was sick and dying that several of her old label mates helped to raise funds for her to be able to afford her treatment and so on. But here she was, once having topped the charts, now embarrassed to have to take this charity.
Yeah, that was terrible, actually. You know, she had 20 or more hits, depends on how you define hits, throughout her career. Most of them were after she left Motown. They were just lower down on the chart. She should have been able at least to afford health care. Come to think of it, that was another legal problem. After the union of vocalists had not kept up the payments that they were supposed to receive from the record companies and send on to the insurance companies, they just let them lapse, and that also caused a lot of people, including Mary, I should say a lot of vocalists, not to have the health insurance they basically had paid for over the years. So she was very embarrassed at that time. Her car was repossessed. She was kicked out of her apartment where she was living with at least one, possibly two of her four children, and was forced to ask her former friends and, in fact, her former enemies in the record business to send thousands of dollars to help her out. Now, they did. They did a good job. A lot of them, people like Rod Stewart and, in fact, Berry Gordy, sent thousands of dollars, and she got more from the Rhythm and Blues Foundation in Washington, D.C. But still, she was basically out on the street with hat in hand when she should have been easily able to afford something at, you know, with her status in the vocal world.
Berry Gordy would go on to pay for her funeral costs. You write that this was the last Motown reunion, for all intents and purposes, that saw this label sort of come back together for one of its own. What was that scene like?
Obviously, it was emotional, since it was about the death of one of their original stars. And it involved a lot of people singing songs of hers a cappella, or saying their spoken word lyrics. Smokey Robinson sang My Guy, and I believe Stevie Wonder sang My Girl, which was the follow-up to My Guy. She didn't sing it, but it was obviously related to her. A lot of people were crying, and her entire family was there, her extended family included, which included a lot of the Womack family. She married first Cecil Womack and then had a common-law marriage with Curtis Womack, so there were quite a few Womacks there and most of the big people in the record business. It was very emotional. She was laid to rest in a mausoleum with a lot of other record business and Hollywood stars. And it, as you indicated, it really was the last big family gathering of Motown. They all considered themselves a family in the beginning. By that time, when Mary died, they had moved to L.A. and everyone was splitting up and going their separate ways. So it was the last big hurrah for the original Motowners.
Your book basically was helped along by the existence of several hours of tapes of interviews that Mary Wells did in the early 90s that had only recently come to light. I don't think they've really been publicly heard. And I wondered, you know, with all of the addiction she seemed to battle, she was a heavy smoker, she had many men in and out of her life. I mean, listening to that, do you hear a happy woman? Do you hear someone who's bitter about the way things turned out? Or was she able to look back on her legacy with any sort of pride?
Oh, she definitely looked back on her legacy with pride. She talked about how she had helped stabilize and basically keep going a company that was very important in American musical life and really in American racial life, too. But the underlying sadness was there not because she felt bitter, but basically because she was a sad person throughout her life. She had grown up with a father, or at least she called him her stepfather. It wasn't clear who her actual father was, but her stepfather had physically abused her mother, and her mother was probably an alcoholic. The father may have been too. This doesn't lead you to have a positive thought about the world in general. So she was always struggling against the underlying sadness, which she probably inherited from her own childhood. But she was calm on her deathbed in the sense that she thought she had achieved what she wanted to achieve, in that she was had been a big star and had helped found a good company. And I think, in her words, she had kept people happy for a while. Unfortunately, she had not kept herself happy to the extent that everyone wants to keep themselves happy. So it's in a sense, a tragic story.
We've been speaking with Peter Benjaminson, the author of Mary Wells, The Tumultuous Life of Motown's First Superstar. Peter, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.